Write that down, Fumi Saito.
Hey, hello from Burbank, California. Thank you for joining us for another episode. Write that down. On the Fight Game Media Network, my name is Justin Nipper. I edit for FightGameMedia.com. Staff writer, WrestlingObserver.com. Also work for Pro Wrestling Noah, Cyber Fight, Inc. And I'm back with Japan's leading pro wrestling author and broadcast journalist and commenter, sociologist, historian, Mr. Fumi Saito. We are talking the NWA Championship in Japan and its significance from the 70s, from the 60s, late 50s, into the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and a little bit of the 2000s. We talk about Luthez. We talk about Ric Flair. We talk about the differences of what the NWA Championship represented in the 70s and how much more prestigious it was at certain points in time. This is a very interesting one, so please enjoy. Check it out. If you have not already, please subscribe to the Fight Game Media Network, the podcast feed, particularly. It's on Spotify, Apple, wherever you are usually listening to your podcast. Please hit the subscribe button because it helps us very much. All right, let's jump in. All right, so today, the NWA Championship in Japan.
And NWA Champions.
NWA Champions in Japan. Very prestigious time for the NWA Champions when they would come over to Japan, usually All Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yeah, they started with JWA, Nippon Pro Wrestling, before All Japan, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I believe that the Japan as a market was responsible for making more legitimate, you know, I mean, as far as NWA goes, because Japan as a market was always something that would still be challenging American market, the whole industry, not just wrestling business, but, you know, that Japan's, you know, economy, you know, just Japanese economy trying to be number two or number three in the whole world kind of thing. It is the whole mentality of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But Japan was still challenger, that not a number one spot, but NWA was almost like a symbol of something that you have to conquer or something. You know what I'm saying?
It was like the FIFA World Cup. It was the NBA championship. It was the Super Bowl kind of thing. It was the main treasure that...
And also something that Japan didn't create, but it was much bigger. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Global. Yeah. Global scale.
Yeah, so that was the theme of whole Japanese wrestling industry. And I'm talking about the world heavyweight champion, Luthez, that the very first NWA champion that came to Japan back in 1957, with Ricky Dozen at the Korakuen Stadium, you know, the Korakuen Stadium, the baseball stadium, instead of Korakuen Hall. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And it was... What was interesting about this NWA thing, National Wrestling Alliance, is that the Luthez, undisputed world champion at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was not very much undisputed either, because November of 1957, it was Luthez's very first trip. But the June of the same year, 1957, NWA World Heavyweight title start disputing themselves, you know what I'm saying? That June of 1957 in Chicago, Edward Carpentier beat Luthez to become NWA champion already. I mean, like five, six months prior to Luthez's first trip to Japan, that Edward Carpentier started defending his NWA world title all over the place. At the same time, Luthez still traveling as a champion and defending his world title all over the place. And so much of undisputed world title, right?
Mm-hmm.
And wherever Edward Carpentier, you know, loses and drops his belt, another world heavyweight title created. Like in Boston, that Killer Kowalski beat Edward Carpentier to become world heavyweight champion. they wouldn't say NWA, but as a spin-off, as a result, another world heavyweight title was created. Edward Carpentier, a couple years later, you know, comes to Los Angeles and drops the title to Freddie Blassie. Therefore, undisputed world title become another spin-off world title that the WWA, Worldwide Wrestling Associates, it was created, and Los Angeles market had its own world title. That Carpentier did that back home in Montreal, and he dropped the title in Albuquerque, New Mexico, of all places, and that the New Mexico, the Albuquerque, New Mexico promoter created title. And there was another world title in Denver, and also Minneapolis and Omaha, Nebraska, that Vern Gagne wanted to use this leverage, you know, that to beat the current champion so that you can create AWA, right? And so much of that, the Luthes was type of, you know, world heavyweight champion, the world traveling champion at that, that if he loses in that part of the world, another world title will always be created. So we have to keep that in mind. Anyhow, that the November of 1957, then undisputed world heavyweight champion, they didn't even announce it was NWA in Japan. He was the world heavyweight champion.
Sure. So it had a different kind of, technically it had a different nuance, but a lot of people assumed.
Yeah, it was NWA World Heavyweight title, but I looked through, they Ricky Dawson filmed the title match, and they made a movie, right? And that there was the TV footage, and there was a program written, like a print, you know, material that, none of those old footage or that the old magazine or booklet had NWA name on it, which is weird. That Luthes, world heavyweight champion, that's it. So NWA, that story was more or less created a little bit later on, you know. But this is NWA, okay? World Wrestling Alliance, you know, St. Louis, Missouri. And Luthes came to Japan and defended his world title for the first trip to Japan. And 1957 version of Ricky Dozan, of course, in his prime, that the kingpin, that the king of pro wrestling, right, in Japan, and challenging world heavyweight title finally for the first time. And Ricky Dozan's so smart, he shouldn't win. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because if he beat Luthes upon his first arrival, that would be the end of long story, huh?
Sure.
Yeah, so in that, you just have to, you know, realize that the people expected that the Ricky Dozan would win the title then, but Ricky Dozan was smarter, that the not winning was actually better. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah, and he had two title matches, one at the Korakuen Stadium, baseball stadium, and 4 days later at Osaka, this big swimming pool that can hold 20,000 people. They had that, and then two Broadways, you know. The one at the Korakuen Stadium was like a no, two out of three fall was no fall, 60 minutes all the way. And the first meeting, you know, announced as two out of three fall match, right? But none of them had the pinfalls, not one fall. It's like zero against zero all the way, 60 minutes. Whoo, that was a good match kind of thing. And they made a movie out of that. And 4 days later, they had another match in Osaka, another title match. And it was like one fall each. And the third fall was double count out where Luthes had an airplane spin, you know, that Ricky Dozan on his shoulder, spin. And both of them go out of the ring over the top rope, and they didn't make the count.
I remember seeing footage of that, and the people were just so shocked and amazed that when they crashed out of the ring. It was really, was it maybe more unbelievable for that time to see something so, I guess.
I mean, both guys, yeah, spinning with airplane spin move, and both guys, you know, just collapse out of the ring from
pretty top, hard fall top up
onto the floor, and neither of them made a count.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like a convincing draw. Like, well, they fought so hard that it was good match. It's okay to not have a clear winner or something. and that spells to be continued sign, right? And then actually after that, they traveled around, you know, Japan, 8 more cities or so, and then had 7 more single matches. They didn't announce it as the title match, but at the building, it looks like a title match, huh?
Sure. It felt like one, too.
Yeah, yeah. So they actually had unannounced at the time, I mean, non-televised Ricky Dawson and Ruthless single match around the country, and they did the big numbers. And at the end of the trip, they went to Okinawa and had another single match. Okinawa at the time was not part of Japan.
It was
U.S. territory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Okinawa wouldn't be returned to Japan until like 1975.
Sure. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So what the reason Ricky Dawson periodically, like a couple, 3 times a year, went to Okinawa was to buy U.S. dollars, you know?
Ah.
Yeah, yeah. It's different world, different time, different economy that you'd be paying American wrestlers with U.S. dollars, you know, but the currency is different and the structure and the rules, the regulations were different. You know, you don't go to banks and buy U.S. dollar at the time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ricky Dawson, you know, ran show a couple of times, you know, in Okinawa a couple of times a year, then get dollars back home, you know. So that was part of the deal. Anyhow, so 1957, this we're talking about NWA story today, World National Wrestling Alliance, that it was like a Japanese wrestling market and Japanese wrestling press, you know, that the wrestling journalism community all, you know, pretty much wrote up that the NWA, not the NWA, but the Ruthless was the undisputed world champion. People don't dispute that, and Ricky Dawson couldn't beat him. And actually, he came back, and yeah, and also following a year, 1958, you and I talked about that the origin of International Heavyweight title, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Ruthless, following year, dropped the NWA title to Dick Hutton, you know. And when Ricky Dawson and Ruthless had a so-called title match in Los Angeles that August of 1958. Ruthless wasn't NWA world champion, but they announced it as some kind of title match. And count out finish, Ricky Dawson beat Ruthless in Los Angeles and brought they didn't bring the physical championship belt, but they brought the title back and announced it. It was International Heavyweight title that Ricky Dawson beat Ruthless for. And that version of International title stayed in Japan forever. All the way till today's part of Triple Crown, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And we're talking about NWA and the affiliation with Japanese wrestling market, that the JWA, Nippon Pro Wrestling, did not become NWA member until like 1967. Yeah. Hmm. Well, think about it. This is after Ruthless, none of those NWA champions came to Japan. See, Dick Hutton came to Japan, but when he wasn't champion. Pat O'Connor came to Japan, but he wasn't NWA champion at the time. Buddy Rogers actually never came to Japan.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. He was one. Yeah. Nature Boy Buddy Rogers was one wrestler who never had Japan tour. Yeah. And Gene Kuniski, the world heavyweight champion, NWA world heavyweight champion, he came to Japan 67 and 68. And we talked about that too. Gene Kuniski, as NWA champion, came to Japan twice while he was holding this NWA world title, the 67 and 68, two years in a row, that he came to Japan and challenged Giant Baba's International Heavyweight title instead of defending his NWA world title. So NWA world heavyweight title wasn't defended in Japan until 1969. It was Dory Funk Jr. era. Are you with me?
Yes. The Dory Funk Jr. era. Yeah. Now, how regularly was Dory Funk Jr. wrestling at that time in Japan?
In Japan. The first trip he came was the fall of 1969, just 6-7 months after he beat Gene Kuniski in Tampa, Florida. Like 28-year-old new generation world champion, and they rolled up so much that Japan was still challenger, that the Giant Baba would be challenging Dory Funk Jr. for the title. Antonio Inoki, then what, the 27-year-old, like young superstar Antonio Inoki, challenging Dory Funk Jr. for the title. And this very first trip of Dory Funk Jr. as World Heavyweight Champion, defended his title against both Baba and Inoki, and both had 60-minute Broadway that, whoa, Baba couldn't beat him, whoa, Inoki couldn't beat him, and they took the world title home. I mean, Dory made Dory Funk Jr. unbeatable champion. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And it came back the following year, 1970. They did that. At that time, Baba defended his international heavyweight title against Dory Funk, but Inoki still challenged the Dory Funk's world heavyweight title as a challenger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And 71 on, that Dory Funk, Terry Funk came to Japan at least a couple, three times a year, every year for the next 20 years. Yeah.
Mm.
And Baba always kind of switch affiliate, because up until like 71, 72, Dory Funk Jr. would come to JWA to defend his title. But upon Giant Baba's opening of All Japan Pro Wrestling in October of 1972, the Amarillo, Texas quickly switched the affiliate. Dory Funk Sr., I mean, still alive at the time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Dory Funk Sr. signed a deal with Japan, I mean, Giant Baba's All Japan Pro Wrestling, and Dory and Amarillo was the company that was supplying American talent to Giant Baba for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to go to all the Giant Baba's All Japan, you got to go through Dory Funk's, either senior or junior. And then in that ring, Giant Baba always treated Dory and Terry Funk as American babyface from that time on. Interesting, huh?
What year was that from right then?
73 on.
So right from the beginning of around All Japan is when...
Yeah, very first opening show was like October of 1972. That was All Japan's opening series. Mm-hmm. They had Bruno Sammartino and Dory Funk Sr. and Terry Funk. See, Dory Funk Jr. was the world traveling champion. He couldn't come to Japan. But the Dory Funk Sr. and Terry Funk came instead. And following year, and then also that year's, Golden Rookie, young Jumbo Tsura was sent to Amarillo, Texas to debut and trained under the Funks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Rookie Jumbo was already challenging Dory Funk Jr. in Amarillo. And 73 on, yes, NWA World title was always defended in All Japan's Giant Baba's All Japan ring. From Dory Funk dropping that, title to Harley Race, right? Mm-hmm. Blonde hair Harley Race at that. And Harley Race dropping the belt to Jack Briscoe in Houston, Texas. Then Jack Briscoe will come. And very famous tour was January of 74, that Dory Funk and Harley Race and Jack Briscoe, all three, that the former and current world champion, came to Japan together. Yeah.
That must have been a big deal, yeah.
Oh, real big deal, yeah. That's the famous picture that Jack Briscoe holding red version of NWA belt and Dory Funk and Harley Race standing next to Jack Briscoe. The famous photo?
Yeah. It's a famous photo, and it's not something that you would see in American magazines at the time. Not all
I
those
guess
guys
not
together.
If you think about the baby, who's babyface and heels, right?
Right. It depends. Yeah. And they would switch it a lot, right? When, somebody might be a babyface in Japan, but they could go home and be a total heel.
Or
vice versa.
Total babyface in America, but when he comes to Japan, he'd be just American heel.
Sure. Yeah.
And also, Dory Funk against Dory Funk against Jack Briscoe. Jack Briscoe against Harley Race. Harley Race against Dory Funk. This main event taking place all over the United States, that they shouldn't be photographed together.
Right.
Yeah. But in Japan, yeah, they traveled together and they were on the bullet train together. And yeah, actually, during that tour, Jack Briscoe, Harley Race, and Dory Funk, along with Giant Baba and Dick Baya Destroyer and Rookie Jumbo Tsura, they all switched around and had a single match against one another, title match or not. So every single night, it was some kind of dream match. People who grew up, you know, like watching that portion of Old Japan Pro Wrestling, like Baba's prime time and very like pro NWA, the undisputed world heavyweight champion and the biggest thing in wrestling and all that, that older fan, older generations wrestling fan in Japan, like over 60, they still believe NWA was the only thing they believed in.
Right. It was the be all end all. It was the global stage. NWA was where the best wrestlers in the world would meet and come and put it on the line and go for the title.
But realistically, in East Coast, New York, WWE, today's WWE, but the then WWF existed with people like Bruno Sammartino and Pedro Morales and, you know, and NWA, AWA, Vern Gagne's AWA, that the Midwest, but it's pretty big territory, like AWA is not just Minnesota, but Wisconsin, Illinois, to North and South Dakota, Nebraska, all the way to Denver, and at the end, like it went all the way to like San Francisco, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Manitoba, Canada. So AWA also was pretty big territory too, but for some reason, that the real hardcore, not hardcore, but the reading-oriented Japanese wrestling fans from the 70s, into 80s and 90s too, for that matter, that NWA World Wrestling, not the National Wrestling Alliance World Heavyweight title was it. Yeah, and then when I dispute it, they kind of get mad at me though, even to this day.
Really?
Yeah, because they something they believed in so much as a kid, don't violate that.
It's like telling them Santa Claus doesn't exist, huh?
In a way, yeah, no, or... there was another major league or, you know.
And we all, I think no matter how much of an expert any of us are, I think often we all tend to go back and look at our early generation of wrestling that was happening as the best generation. The generation we grew up with.
And it was better or something.
Better or like, and I'm already getting to the point where I find myself saying, oh, I think I like older stuff, but, and I'm stopping myself because I sound like how people older than me sounded like when I was young. I sound the same way. So I'm noticing that we are attached to.
Yeah, like growing up like in the 80s, you know, like Hulk Hogan's version of WWF is bigger than what it is today. I mean, in your head.
Oh, of course. Of course.
Yeah.
Well, I liked it at the end of the Hulkamania in the late 80s and 90s, and then there was a big dip for WWF.
Yeah.
And that was kind of going off a little bit off script, but when I was watching it, it was hard to explain or understand where are all these other big companies coming from, but this company is telling me that they're the biggest in the world because I see other companies. And then you read the magazines and you read about Japan, you read about Mexico and these big crowds, and you get interested.
Oh, Dallas World Class or NWA Crockett or
all, you know, of it. Yeah, so,
or even Jerry Lawler's Tennessee, hot territory, you know.
But in Japan, I think it was more clarified that the NWA, whoever is involved with the NWA, is the best of the best in the world. And you're going to see the best with if you see an NWA champion.
More like a greatest and biggest wrestling governing body or something.
Yeah, because
it wasn't company. It was like they recognized that there were so many different areas and territories, independent companies all around the U.S., like 25 different companies. It was all members of NWA. Therefore, it's above everybody or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like FIFA. It's a governing body that doesn't necessarily run.
To prove the point, it's like, see, Von Erich's Dallas territory was, you know, popular and big, but Ric Flair, the champion, I'm talking about early 80s, Ric Flair or Harley Race would come to Dallas once or twice a year to make world heavyweight championship match happen. and that the, whomever at the top, either Kerry Von Erich or Kevin Von Erich or sometimes David Von Erich, they would challenge NWA champion and does not win. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, well, yeah, NWA must be above those companies. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Or go to Tennessee and Jerry Lawler, you know, challenge NWA champion or AWA champion for that matter, that those governing body must be above those territories or something. It's just ideas of it, you know, because other territory didn't recognize their own world champion. That's true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'd be like the St. Louis champion or no, or South Florida champion. Yeah, but
there was such thing called Missouri heavyweight title.
Yes, you know? That was Harley Race's big...
Yeah. And also there was Georgia heavyweight champion, Florida mm-hmm. heavyweight champion. And so it's like, whoa, there must be local champions.
Sure.
Or Southern heavyweight champion, like Lawler. Yeah. Something that's like right. that. So in Japan, NWA world champion. I mean, either it'd be Jack Briscoe or Harley Race or a little bit later on Ric Flair. Yeah. They would come in and wouldn't lose the title. Or a couple, three times, Harley Race was, you know, defeated by Giant Baba, but the end of the tour, like 10 days later, Giant Baba will drop the title back to Harley Race.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, couldn't win. Mm-hmm. You cannot keep NWA title in Japan. That made it even bigger and, you know, better, you know, I mean, bigger and better than Baba's PWF title. I mean, in wrestling fans' mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also that the Antonio Inoki's New Japan company couldn't invite NWA champion. That even made NWA that much more special, right?
Right. And at that time, Inoki would bring in not necessarily big international stars. They'd turn into stars, guys like Tiger Jeet Singh and guys sure. like people
who... Johnny Powers.
Johnny Powers, NWF title.
Early on, Carl Gotch, of course, and mm-hmm. aged Luthes. You know, and somebody like Antonino Rocca, special referee or something.
But they weren't associated with NWA yet. Or at
a little bit, because Los Angeles, Mike LaBelle territory, that was technically NWA affiliate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you still couldn't bring in current NWA world champion, like Jack Briscoe, or Harley Race, Dory Funk Jr. It's all Japan guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And actually, there's another backstory that the 2 years in a row, like 74, 75, that Antonio Inoki's New Japan applied for NWA membership at the Las Vegas conference, and it was denied or something. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, Inoki couldn't be NWA member. Therefore, NWA is bigger and better, and they choose Giant Baba over Inoki, something like that. And it was all written up in magazines. So it's like, wow, NWA choose Giant Baba's Old Japan over Antonio Inoki's New Japan Pro Wrestling. Therefore, Giant Baba must be better promoter for American wrestling community or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess that's the image that they would have, right?
Yeah. Well, Inoki fans, you know, always believed in Antonio Inoki.
Sure.
And title, NWF title, right?
Mm.
Very similar, but different. Inoki always had this NWF title, and that was your marquee title. And then Inoki defended the title for 7 straight years and never lost, almost. And that was New Japan world, you know, New Japan universe, Antonio Inoki's world. But in back of hardcore wrestling fans' mind, that they wish NWA champion would come to New Japan and have a match against Antonio Inoki, which never happened. Yeah.
Mm-mm.
So that made NWA myth that much bigger.
Mm. Yeah, especially those for the first 10 years of those All Japan shows of the NWA, even into the 80s when Ric Flair would come over, that was skipping a little bit, but it was always a huge...
Baba wouldn't deal. Challenge Ric Flair for the title. He would...
No.
Jumbo Tsuruta era. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
Jumbo couldn't beat Ric Flair, so wow, NWA title still strong, huh? Yeah.
Was there ever a special, like a traditional or regular occasion each year when the NWA champion would come in? Would he come in during the summer? Would come in, or would it be
During summer, it's the Funks. First half of the summer, Dory and Terry Funk, And second half of summer, it's male maskers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like a calendar year. Yeah, because the kids come to shows, right? So mm-hmm. male maskers season, August, you know?
They're out of school.
Yeah, pretty much every year. Summer action series, they call it. You know? Male maskers and his brother, Dos Caras, and heel and wrestlers. And mm-hmm. Mil Maskers always worked babyface, so that was a summer deal. And spring and fall, then the NWA champion, to make them even more special, is that they wouldn't take 5-week tour. NWA world champion will come in just 1 week during that tour,
right?
Then leaves.
And it wouldn't be all singles matches, it would be maybe one or two marquee matches.
They travel so much that they sleep on. Yeah, and then defend title, usually like a 60-minute Broadway match that the local superstar would almost win but never does, you know, then take the championship back home, and saying that the TV commentator saying that they are so busy that they sleep on planes. I believed that as a kid, though.
Hey, I mean, it's looking at some of these guys' schedules, having to be back in the States after a week in Japan only a day later, I believe it.
And then Harley Race was telling that it's a true story that he leaves Japan in one afternoon and get on the plane, go straight back to St. Louis and defend that title that night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he really did that. And that night and the next morning, he traveled to San Juan, Puerto Rico and defend his title the same week. Something like that. Yeah, actually, truth, you know. Mm-hmm. NWA World Champion was like that. Yeah. And everywhere he went, you were, I guess, assigned to do the 60-minute Broadway everywhere you went. So you were basically working 60-minute match every night of the week. You know, there's a footage that Harley Race against Dusty Rhodes all week, 7 days in a row, every night, 60 minutes.
Nice workout.
But they must have done the exact same matches when you think about it.
True, you but know? Also it wasn't a time where people could just record and share it immediately. It was also like it didn't feel repeated.
Fresh. Decades before the internet or even videotape for that matter. Yeah. So 70s, right?
Mm. Did the Broadways stop happening in the 80s? Or did it? Because it felt like there were more Japanese stars that were popular in the 80s than the 70s with the NWA championship. It became less about
in
it.
In the 80s in Japan, the top matchups are Japanese against Japanese. You know, like Fujinami against Choshu, Jumbo against Tenryu. So it's just a subtle heel and subtle babyface. It was more like a serious competition.
So it didn't feel like the NWA title was as, it was important. It still was important, but it felt maybe a little less exciting.
And also Japanese style kind of evolved, you know, hard hitting, you know.
Right.
Not exactly Ric Flair face first bump and stuff like that.
More martial arts influence with the UWF and Tiger Mask and styles evolving.
Jumbo Tsuru against Tenryu, that they kind of trusted each other and go everything hard way, right?
Mm-hmm. And same with Hanson Brody. And
Hanson Brody was actually bigger draw than your NWA champion. I mean, when you think about it, because their regular guys were drawing 5,000 to 7,000 to 8,000 people night after night after night, that kind of draw. Look, interestingly enough, that you would think that Stan Hansen against NWA World Champion would happen in Japan, right? Baba couldn't do it because you have to make NWA Champion look good, but you have, your Stan Hansen Bruiser Brody has to look good. Let's not do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in St. Louis, there was Brody against Ric Flair, 60-minute, Broadway in St. Louis. But it was like, Brody must have worked a real slow pace, 60 minutes, huh?
Is that the Broadway that the MTV came over to record?
The footage exists, yeah.
Yeah, I think I've seen some footage where they had the extra lighting and they had the full MTV crew and they set up the announcers at the table and everything.
Yeah, And
I think it was that one.
Still 2 out of 3 4 match era too.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
But you don't want to videotape Bruiser Brody being one, you know, pinned 1-2-3 in the second fall.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. So and now that when we look back, they must have done something.
That makes me want to ask you a question about the, I guess, how the NWA champion would end up. Would they try or not? Would they try? Would the NWA? Yeah,
there's a different reason for it, though, because up until Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe and Harley Race era, Giant Baba really treated NWA champion like NWA champion, right? But on from Ric Flair era begins, that Baba wouldn't even challenge Ric Flair for the world title. It just gave the opportunity to either Jumbo or Tenryu or Misawa Tiger Mask for that matter. When Ricky Steamboat came in as NWA World Heavyweight Champion like in 89, Baba didn't even put him in the main event.
That's right. And he didn't connect the same way he did in the States.
Yeah, yeah. The Ricky Steamboat would connect in the rest of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Ric Flair era was when you think about it, late 80s Ric Flair worked just like Harley Race, though.
Yeah.
Very similar style.
Very serious compared to the rest of his work. You would really see him get serious. He wouldn't do as much of the exaggerated spots and begging off. It was a little more of a competition. It was more like he was more like Harley Race.
Yeah, it worked exactly like Harley Race, but at the same time, it was the Baba's choice of challenger for the All Japan side was always going to be Jumbo Tsura that time on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because, just slightly different because you already had your, All Japan regular American roster where would NWA champion fill in? Come in 1 week and defend the title and go home, right?
Mm.
And the main event would be people like Stan Hansen or Bruiser Brody. Yeah. And just NWA affiliate in different ways that it's not as special like you're above Japanese wrestling. It's just different. Yeah. And also people wanted Jumbo to win the title, right?
Mm.
And that this NWA thing, probably Baba didn't want Jumbo to win the NWA title. Instead, Jumbo in 84 beat Nick Bockwinkel in Japan and really became AWA World Heavyweight Champion. He traveled back to Midwest and defended his title, and he went back and forth a couple of times, and he really had champion tour, and TV crew followed him as AWA World Champion. And Ric Flair, probably Jumbo and Ric Flair didn't really click as much. And also, it was around the time that the Vince McMahon's WWF the national expansion tour had begun, right, already, 84. And NWA became more and more NWA Jim Crockett promotion, that North Carolina, the West Virginia, this southern NWA territory kept Ric Flair full time, and then other territory like NWA Florida, the Pensacola, the NWA Georgia, even St. Louis, the Central States, they were dying out, they're closing shops. And in 1990, Sam Machinik finally retired all the affiliates of all these membership thing and the biggest governing body of professional wrestling. It became almost yesterday's news within the United States.
Mm.
Does that make
sense? Yes.
Yeah, same NWA World Heavyweight Champion, though, but the Ric Flair became more and more Jim Crockett promotion company champion, in a way.
And by, 1988, we really didn't see much of Flair or the NWA Championship again
in Japan.
Yeah, at least for a couple of years, yeah.
Yeah, then NWA Crockett promotion expanded so much that they kind of expanded, like WWF, and start running all over, you know, start running shows all over the country. You know, at the same time, they had to sell the company. Oh, we bought Bill Watts, you know, Midwest, Mid-South company, UWF company, and they combined, and Jim Crockett company became even bigger and moved office from Charlotte, North Carolina to Dallas, Texas, and a whole bit, and just couldn't operate that way, and then ended up selling the whole company to Ted Turner's company, Ted Turner's Television.
WCW. And,
yeah, and then it's the beginning of, yeah, beginning of WCW. What was unique was, or the strange, was that the new company called World Championship Wrestling under Ted Turner umbrella, right? They called their, they kept calling their World Championship NWA World Title.
Right.
Then slowly but surely, they started to recognize two sets of belts, which was confusing.
Yeah, you'd really need, it would almost be harder to figure out what was going on in TV. So you need your magazine and match the belt with the caption and see which one was which. So you really get.
And one summer, you know, Great American Bash, this up and coming superstar Sting beat Ric Flair for NWA World, you know, world title. And pretty soon that New Japan and World Championship Wrestling became business partner as of 1990. And then they started recognizing Lex Luger's reign as WCW World Heavyweight Champion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you still had NWA World Title, and sometimes this Ric Flair or Gold Belt would be referred as WCW International Heavyweight Title.
Right.
That was confusing, wasn't it?
It was hard to understand, and they wouldn't show the full matches on the programs in the States. They would show the clips, and it would be kind of a couple minutes explanation, and you kind of still not know what's going on, but you'd see the title on a Masachono, and it was, it was
and
confusing time.
And the captions say that the title match was held between Masachono and Ravishing Rick Rude in Tokyo, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, see, we were talking about NWA champion in Japan, but now all of a sudden we had to talk about what was happening in America at the time. It affected
interesting,
each
yeah.
Yeah.
There was that, and it was nearby, but I can't remember exactly at the moment if it was before or after Chono, but there was also the Ric Flair Fujinami issue. 92, yeah?
Yeah, because 1990, they revived NWA World Heavyweight Champion in Japan in second annual G1 Climax. That was that first year then?
Yeah, 91. Wasn't it?
91. It was so second annual G1 Climax then.
It with was, Chono and Muto.
That wasn't NWA title.
Wasn't that G1? The G1 finals?
Yeah, G1 final and also NWA World Heavyweight title match. Masachono beat Rick Rude to become NWA champion. And people didn't think it was, is that the same NWA that we know of? Yeah, but he has Ric Flair belt.
That was all that they had. But, you know, at around that time,
it was in 92. It was 92.
That same year when I was watching WWF TV.
Actually, then that the Fujinami thing happened before then, because it was 91 Tokyo Dome, Starcade in Tokyo Dome, IWGP champion Fujinami against NWA World champion Ric Flair. And in Tokyo, though, if you were in the building, you believed Fujinami became double champion, beating Ric Flair. Okay? Yeah, it was 91. And Chono thing didn't happen until 92 then. Yeah, March 20th, I just looked up. March 21st of 1991 at the Tokyo Dome, Starcade Tokyo Dome, the Tatsumi Fujinami beat Ric Flair for the NWA World Heavyweight Title champion and became second Japanese NWA World Champion. I mean, after Baba, right? And clearly the affiliate was changed, that the NWA is doing business with New Japan. By then, on the other hand, Giant Baba pretty much cut all ties from American wrestling, and that was 1990 was the year that the Giant Baba recognized Triple Crown champion, combining international title and PWF title and a UN title together. The Triple Crown became All Japan's world title, sort of. and the New Japan signed the deal with WCW and it became partnership. And the first thing they did was basically Ric Flair against Fujinami at the Tokyo Dome, and Fujinami won the title. And the building, yes, it looked like Fujinami had become double champ, world champion. And it was carefully booked that the over the top rope DQ happened before Fujinami pinned Ric Flair. Does that make sense?
A little bit. Yeah. No, it makes sense. It makes sense. It's just, it's, you know, it was a confusing time. The same belt was on WWF TV in 92. Ric Flair would bring that in and I would see that.
Right.
They called it the real world championship.
After he left WCW.
It was 1992 though.
No, it was when Fujinami.
Or 91.
It was 91, yes.
91.
And shortly after that, Ric Flair really left dispute with Jim Hard.
Yes.
President of WCW, then president. Yeah. So it became really even more confusing time, you know.
Yeah.
Ric Flair, of all people, left WCW and brought the physical belt to New York. This is like almost revolutionizing.
Yeah, but they wouldn't say NWA or WCW anything. They would just say real world
champion and real world title.
Yeah. And he would just say this belt is better than the WWF belt. But I, yeah, as a kid, line,
you're just like, what the hell's going on? The champion from another company came, actually moved to WWF, which was exciting, right?
Very, very much so.
After this Fujinami beating Ric Flair at the Tokyo Dome, actually following month, Fujinami traveled to St. Petersburg, Florida for Slamboree and actually was a challenger, you know. But in Japan, title, NWA world title was up in the air, up for grabs. And second match, Flair beat Fujinami and unified the title or something. Yeah. So they wrapped it up, sort of.
It was one of those things. It was very interesting, but how that match ended with Fujinami and Flair and how they never really followed up much afterwards. It was just a one and done sort of feeling event. And that was that.
But it was explained in Japan, though, that, you know, controversial ending, that over-the-top rope thing happened before Fujinami pinned Flair with ground cobra twist. And the two referees, that Bill Alfonso called it DQ with over-the-top rope, but second referee Taiga Hattori clearly pinned 1-2-3, you know, the counted 1-2-3, Fujinami beating Ric Flair with ground cobra twist, you know. And yeah, so it was like, you gotta favor local decision. How's that?
You know, I don't think something like that could happen today.
No.
Not even close.
Because everybody's watching, the whole world is all internet and streaming service and all the, you know, video footage will be out like next minute.
Yeah, and you could really scrutinize and look very closely and rewind and fast forward. Back then, it was just a moment.
But if you learn the history, that's how they did the world title thing, like in 1920s and 1930s and 1940s. With Ed Strangler Lewis to Joe Stecker to what, Golden Greek, Jim Londos to, I don't know, Gorgeous George or somebody. They always had very, you know, creative controversy ending that at the building, you know, you thought your favorite won the title, but when you see the next week on TV or something that the title was back to champion. They did that with the Hulk Hogan against Nick Bakwinko in Minnesota. I mean, more than once. In the building at St. Paul Civic Center, it looked like Hulk Hogan beat Nick Bakwinko, and he actually wore the belt in his waist and left the ring. And following week, somebody like AWA president Stanley Blackburn or something come on TV, and the title was back to Nick Bakwinko, you know? And something like, they always did that, though, in wrestling.
Yeah. It's kind of this...
something you can't do today, right?
I mean, in ways, yes, but it's just It's different and it's not exactly the way we're watching is different. I think that's the big key.
Yeah. And also we have, I wouldn't say better, but different kind of understanding.
I think fan that's in their 20s or 30s today has so many more resources to build up their wisdom and knowledge. Wisdom's and experience.
Fine, but you know, I mean, think so much of it and, you know, get carried away by what you just watched. It's not healthy though. It's okay to believe in what you just saw, and your memory as a child, you know, is just so vivid that we're talking about things from 30 years ago, and then it just stays in your head. And so today's fan, I think their attention span is shorter, but the memories are much shorter too.
It's more, there's also a higher volume of stuff to watch. There's just so much. It's different.
But remember, today's, not just wrestling fan, but today's music fans don't listen to the entire song.
Right. And they're also, I mean, not as many people are listening on the radio and they, or buying a CD. It's just the way.
Oh, nobody buys CD. Yeah.
The way it's just.
Yeah. Even the music. They only listen to the key phrases for 15 seconds and decide whether you like it or not, you know?
Well, I guess to tie that back into NWA, it's like the NWA title and NWA title matches are definitely not the types of matches that you can really just fly through. And it's not
NWA world title match. Yeah.
You can sit
through and watch at least 35, 40 minutes of it.
And you really... You shouldn't take your eyes off the screen. You know what I mean? No.
Kazuchika Okada does that today.
That's why he's special.
40-minute title match and it go beyond your expectation and give you a better match than you expected. So that can still be done, I think. But back to NWA, I think the whole NWA, the biggest governing body of professional wrestling and undisputed world heavyweight championship and whole bit, it was the constant that was just until 80s, maybe into a little bit into 90s. And we know what happened with Fujinami against Ric Flair at the Tokyo Dome and Slam Boy in 92, G1 Climax final that they recreated NWA world title. When they had WCW World Title already, that Ric Flair gold belt was brought in to Japan, and the tournament final was Masato Chono against Rick Rude, and Masato Chono beat Rick Rude to become NWA World Champion in Japan. And that time we thought this time NWA World Title will stay in Japan, right? But following January, the Tokyo Dome main event, January 4th, 93, that the main event was champion Chono challenger Great Muta. And Great Muta beat Masato Chono to become that version of NWA World title. Then he traveled to America and dropped the title to Barry Windham. And that was the end of it.
And that would be...
Remember? I mean, like Asheville, North Carolina or somewhere.
And again, I remember television back then. It would just be a few minutes highlight on television on Saturday night. So you'd only know so much as a fan over here. So you get a little bit of the idea, and you have to dig around and maybe read magazines.
Physical title matches took place. Great Muta as NWA champion brought the physical belt back to the States. And he defended title against Barry Windham, and Barry Windham won the title and became NWA champion. And pretty much NWA title was forgotten after that point.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting? Because NWA World Heavyweight title resurfaced someplace else with people, it was like a Northeast promoter, like Dennis Caruso's NWA, if you remember.
Yes, in the tri-state area.
Yeah, and the Harley Race model belt, revives, and people like Dan Severn or young Chris Candido, they started defending NWA World title. Yeah.
And you would see it at the indies. You see that indies around.
That version of NWA title came back to Japan, though. Like IWA Japan's Kawasaki Stadium, NWA champion Dan Severn comes over in places like IWA Japan, the deathmatch company, right? Mm. But Dan Severn was NWA, the Hardy West model belt, along with his UFC belt on his shoulder, and comes to Japan and defends his NWA title against guys like Tarzan Goto.
Pretty surreal to say now, but it was normal, yeah, and pretty well known at the time.
Lineage is arguable, you know, because WCW wasn't part of NWA, and groups of lawyers in America really won that copyright, you know, like rights for NWA name, and NWA World Heavyweight title was revived in a way. And if you remember, you know, Naoya Ogawa, you know, of all guys.
Of course. Silver medalist judoka.
Yeah, he won the NWA world title, the Hardy Race model. And 01's Shinya Hashimoto, he also won that version of NWA world title. Well, guys like Steve Corino, he won the world title. And they bounced around, and the guys like Rob Conway, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had an NWA world title, then brought that back to New Japan like in year 2000, and Satoshi Kojima beat him to become once again NWA world champion in Japan. Is that the same NWA or what?
It's something.
We had to scratch the head. Then we were entering dark age of professional wrestling in 2005, that portion of NWA world title was again forgotten. Yeah, because NWA World Title still exists with, you know, Billy Corgan's NWA, and they just, I think that the Lineage is still legal, I guess, that they call themselves NWA, and they got the same logo, and they call them NWA National Wrestling Alliance, and they have their own TV, NWA Power, right?
Well, also right before that, I believe the NWA title, that one we were just talking about, that showed up, and that was the TNA title for a while.
Right, that too. Yeah, the Jeff Jarrett era.
Yes, like right when they started, 2003.
And Shamrock and Sting again.
Sting.
Yeah.
And I think because it was originally NWA TNA.
Right.
And that was kind of the image. Old
fashioned promoter like Jarrett's family believed in NWA at the time.
Mm-hmm.
If you revive NWA, the company would be so legitimate, right?
I think when that started, I felt like that was, aside from the stars that they had, the NWA title was the calling point for those initial pay-per-views. It tried to feel like WCW, like filling that void.
Right, because WCW was no longer, and also there, you know, new company with new concept. Jeff Jarrett created weekly pay-per-view and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was already 20 years ago, huh?
I can't believe that. I can remember. I don't remember who was the champion at the time, but I remember seeing TNA. Couple of years later after that, I think maybe it was Christian Cage was the champion or something.
Yeah. Before that, that's what's a dancing, you know, African guy in
Ron Killings. His name was Ron.
The NWA champion.
And he is in WWE. He's a little Jimmy. What's his name? The name is R-Truth. R-Truth.
Yeah. Right. Yes. R-Truth. Yeah.
He was an NWA champion too. There were a lot of the NWA title in the early 2000s was a bit of a hot potato, and it went to a couple of different companies. 01 for quite a while. 2001, yeah, I remember. Yeah,
and because they were using this Hardy Race model global belt that looks like NWA belt is back. Mm-hmm. It was, yeah.
And for me, when that happened, it felt like 01 had a little bit of an advantage because GHC didn't have, it was a new title completely, and there was no, you know, lineage to older titles over at NOAH.
Right.
But 01 had that they had Hashimoto and they had Otani and they had that NWA title for the time.
Naoya Ogawa too, yeah.
Yeah. So it felt like the NWA, that was maybe before TNA, that was the last serious revival that I can remember of that belt.
Yeah, and somebody like Dan Severn will come in and have good wrestling match, like classic old style professional wrestling match that gives this that version of NWA title, you know, that much rub, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but it, for older fans, it's like, well, that's not NWA, no. You know, so that was like, well, all in all, NWA World Heavyweight title still exists to this day, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Power in Billy Corgan's version.
And yeah, so that, you know, somewhat like for some people, that's the marquee name and image that they can rely on, huh?
Seems that way, but as time goes on, it falls a little bit too into memory. And it's,
yeah, because in the meantime, Vince McMahon's WWE really conquered the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it had a different, they have their own universe history and titles, and they have the Universal title and the World title and SmackDown and Raw title. They have their own, they have their own continuity, their own canon.
Well, all in all, the biggest audience in the world.
That's right.
Biggest marketplace in the world.
But in the 70s, yeah. In the 70s, the NWA title was a thing of prestige and honor.
And the whole concept of traveling world champion, you know, territory to territory, state to state, to town to town. And, you know, Keiji Muto, while he was working NWA Florida territory, that when Ric Flair comes in, everybody's paycheck was much bigger. That's what World Heavyweight Champion does. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. It's
like, I mean, like in the real, you know, I don't know if I should say the actual amount, but the, you know, the guys were making $800 a week, you know, or some people $500 a week, right? Mm-hmm. Then the week Ric Flair came in, and everybody's paycheck was $25,000 to $3,000. Oh my gosh, this week's paycheck so bigger because Ric Flair was drawing 10,000 people for 7 consecutive nights. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what World Heavyweight Champion does for wrestlers, you know. A value for it, you know? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's like another way to look at what the world champion is. Yeah.
That's a great way.
Yeah. Because when Luthes was a world in the world champion, every state, every week, every town, every weekend, whenever Luthes came in, it's like you're a super show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And normally drawing anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 people in that territory. The week Luthes comes in, all of a sudden you're drawing 12,000 to 15,000 people in the bigger building. It's like a big deal. So that's what the world champion was. Yeah. But then again, it was the territory days, and there was no cable television, let alone internet information, and yeah, that the news traveled so slow that, you know, Luthes was doing this, you know, controversy finish that it looks like your local champion, local babyface will almost beat the world heavyweight champion. But somehow, somewhat, that Luthes will keep the belt and leave town. Kind of like that's what Nick Bockwink was doing too. You know, his challenger was always strong. And for somehow, that Bobby Heenan or somebody gets in, and Nick Bockwink will end up keeping title and leave the building.
Flair, I think, would do something very similar. And guys like
similar, and it only worked to 80s. That's it, though.
Well, I think people were able to catch on to the pattern.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's a pattern, people will catch on to it.
And also, what you saw already on cable, they might do the various same or similar match at your house show locally in Baltimore or somewhere, and then people go, have I seen this one?
Right? yeah
or like traditionally, you know, like a Friday night, Saturday night in house shows, they almost rehearse the spot at the, you know, non-televised house shows going to the match, yeah, because not same audience are watching, you know, in next town. Some hardcore fans will travel and drive 3 hours, 5 hours, you know, drive 5-6 hours to get to another town and watch, but a very small portion audience. Yeah.
Even it was almost like a dress rehearsal.
Yeah, because even in the Florida, NWA Florida territory, this is all 7 days a week. It's basically driving distance, right?
Yeah.
But they were still doing the same match every night and not same audience. I mean, it's like from Fort Lauderdale to Miami to, yeah, Tampa, 4 hours away, 5 hours away, you're dealing with completely different live audience. And they wouldn't tell you much on your television.
Right. It would be limited, very limited.
But like in the territory like Japan, the whole country will be watching the same show. So that's different, you know, too.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, and also when Jan Baba beat Jack Briscoe for the first time to become NW World Champion, right? And they televised it and they over and over. But the end of the tour, Jan Baba would quietly drop the title back to Jack Briscoe, non-televised match. And they didn't even say anything on TV. And maybe a month later, I go to a bookstore and read Wrestling Magazine, and black and white page, there's like, oh, there was a title match. Again, the third match that Jack Briscoe won the title back and went home. Then you just find out maybe a month later that TV didn't tell you about that. So I learned something as a kid.
That was the only way.
Yeah, but Baba was, in a way, Baba was honest promoter that when he beat Jack Briscoe, big payday and everything, you can read that on the Jack Briscoe biography, that Baba will honor the promise and drop the title at the end of the tour. He did that with Harley Race three times. He won the title, NWA title, two more times, beating Harley Race. But at the end of the tour, like 10 days later, 2 weeks later, that Harley Race would win the title back in Japan. Actual match take place, non-televised, and Harley Race will take belt home. Non-televised.
Mm.
But, you know, that's honest business too, in a way. And that's why Jan Baba was a very trusted promoter within the American wrestling community, right? And you and I talked about how Antonio Inoki beat Bob Backlund in Japan, kind of relinquished the title in Japan and actually never got beaten. You know what I'm saying? Never dropped the title back to Backlund.
It was kind of a way to protect the image. Way to
treat the business, huh?
Yeah, protect the image, hide things from the fans, but it's not necessarily malicious. It's just, like you said, it's for business.
Yeah, man, the wrestling media in Japan went with it. That in Japan, that you and I talked about that last month, that Bob Backlund against Cowboy Bob, the Big Bad Bobby Duncan, was not an NWA, the WWF title match at the Madison Square Garden. It was Texas Death Match. Therefore, Bob Backlund comes into ring without the belt. And Japanese magazine will take the photo. That's right, Bob Backlund not wearing the belt.
Very tricky.
Oh, very carefully designed, huh?
It's interesting because, again, it's something that we're in a different time period, so we're not going to have, you don't need those skills. Or you do, they just need to be updated to today's age, today's technology. But back then,
I don't even know if today's fan will take this title change that seriously. I don't know.
I mean, titles change every week.
But you still have champion like Roman Reigns with over 1,000 day reign.
And I think that's the only way.
Yeah, if Roman Reigns be beaten on TV or a pay-per-view situation, they'll make big announcement kind of thing. You know, that's a big news.
Yeah.
So that can still be done, but very different. It's the same company anyhow.
The pace of everything is much faster these days. The way people consume their pro wrestling, it's just the timing, like the pace and the rhythm of everything is so much more fast now. Everything you're getting will
still be tested because Roman Reigns really is the longest reign world, the universal champion in modern era, and he still is. And we still don't know when he would drop the title, right? So, yeah. But then again, they created another world heavyweight title. And WWE World Heavyweight title will be crowned at that. Was up Night of Champions in Saudi Arabia? Yeah, I was gonna say Parade of Champions, not the Parade of Champions, Night of the Champions. Yeah, So they will still have world heavyweight title. And any other company can have world heavyweight title, but they can call it world heavyweight title. But, well, realistically, WWE world title will be bigger than the rest.
That's the idea these days, huh?
Yeah. Well, IWGP World Heavyweight Champion is another thing that doesn't mingle with WWE, you know, universe. So, yeah, let's count on New Japan. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, because that's another world title from another company and another country. So that's about the only, you know, believable World Heavyweight Championship these days.
Yeah, that's the case.
Yeah, because AEW World Champion against IWGP World Champion hasn't even happened, you know? Yeah. So I think New Japan will expand with this, you know, streaming pay-per-view, and they will have more shows in America. And that goes with IWGP Women's World Title too. The Mercedes Moné is basically recognized world champion. That let's see how she does. Yeah,
yeah,
because she'll be defending title in Japan and in America. So,
didn't she lose it?
Guess she did, but I guess she did. I'm still talking about her as a champion, but right. I believe that it'll be, you know, like playing catch, though.
I see.
Yeah, yeah, because that would be the headline of women's division, yeah, for quite some time. You know, like, yeah, Iwatani against Moné. Yeah, that's your title match.
And I think...
Which wrestler is a champion at the time, yeah.
It's interesting that what we talked about today, you can sort of use what we talk about today and study how Mercedes Moné and this new IWGP Women's Championship will develop, because we don't know how it's going to develop and what the image of it is going to be. It's still so new right now. So I think it's kind of interesting.
What we know
follow along
is that the world is much smaller place to live.
Yes, yes.
You know what I'm saying? So geographically, it's halfway around the world, you know, that something happening in Tokyo, something happens in LA or something, but it's like the world, because of technology, really is a smaller place to live now.
Mm.
Yeah. So just like you and I always talk about, wrestling is not completely independent with what's happening in the real world.
Mm. It's often quite connected to what's happening.
Yeah, so what's happening right now, we can study, you know, this, like, this is how it works today. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we started out today with 1957 Luthers, you know, undisputed world champion, you know, coming to Japan for the first time and having a title match against Ricky Dozen at the Korakuen Stadium. Korakuen Stadium doesn't even exist anymore. It's Tokyo Dome, right?
Mm. Time flies.
Yeah. Yeah. But then again, wrestling history and how they did things, you know, 60 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, I think we can really rationalize like assumption, or, you know, we can kind of learn what they're going to do, or, you know.
I think, you know,
things can be done or cannot be done.
They say history repeats itself, and sometimes you see the patterns throughout history. Every 20, 30 years, there are similarities.
Yeah. And also, even in wrestling, you know, this is always justified. The wrestler, the superstar that draw people, you know, in numbers, they are champions.
Yeah. And really dictated the business more so.
Of course, it's a paying audience.
Like the stat you were talking about Ric Flair earlier, when he would be on the card and he'd make everybody else so much money. I think that's a big idea.
Yeah. Like you know, next week when you get a paycheck and young, you know, 23-year-old great Muta said, "Oh, wow, look at this paycheck." So the week Ric Flair worked Florida, everybody got the bigger paycheck.
So
he learned that's what world champion does.
That, I think, really hits hard, and no matter what era it is, that shows the kind of person or athlete you have to be you had to be NWA champion. You had a lot of responsibility.
It's not going to be your paycheck next week. This time, you know, that pay-per-view numbers or something like that, or subscribers number or something.
Right? Yeah, right, right. It's going to be subscriber numbers or pay-per-view buys or whatever.
Yeah, so it's much bigger universe.
And
much
T-shirts bigger sold.
Too. Yeah, that too, yeah. So I think, I guess, market's bigger now than ever.
Mm-hmm. But there's also more room for people to be champions of different areas of interest in wrestling. You can be a deathmatch champion. You could be a champion in a different country. You can be a champion, male or female. There's all different.
Yeah, at the same time, the bigger company win, though.
Right?
Yeah, because it's hard to imagine any company would be, you know, I mean, selling more March or pay-per-view number or streaming number than WWE, realistically.
I think only a draw, like you said, is someone who could outdraw a company. You know, somebody like Fuachan is so popular that she can outdraw Stardom with her Twitter account. You know what I mean? It's somebody that's so much bigger than
the account is not as big a money gathering
of course
platform as wrestling streaming. No,
so that's the kind of discussion. It's kind of like we have to design the new parameters. We have to like
people getting used to, you know, buying this streaming iPay-per-view, you know, 5,000 yen, 6,000 yen, like $50-$60 per show on your iPhone. That's the economy we're in right now. Mm-hmm. And you're not talking about 10, 20,000, but you're talking about 100,000 subscriber a show, probably like a 200,000 subscriber. I mean, $50-$60 per show. So the number's getting bigger and bigger now.
And it's a less local territory, and you're selling to people from all over the world.
Yeah, yeah. So that's probably why that the Japanese companies should have English commentary and English play-by-play. Because for the rest of the world, you know, you need English-speaking product.
No, lingua franca. That's what most of the world speaks.
From this, you know, from where I am. Yeah, because if even old Japan had English play-by-play and English commentary, the English-speaking world can buy it, you know. And without this English-speaking commentary and play-by-play, it's so hard to buy those products, right?
It's a higher barrier of entry.
Because wrestling is a universal language. You can watch wrestling and understand and enjoy it.
But the best wrestling is for everybody.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But you still, as a product, pay-per-view product, streaming iPay-per-view product, you need the language.
Yeah.
I think that's the area we live in, right?
Right, yeah. We're still figuring it out, too. It moves really fast. It moves really quickly.
I think so, yeah.
Bottom.
Very good. So did we accomplish what we're going to accomplish today?
You know, well, I was thinking, you know, NWA Championship, it really does change in its character a lot over the years. It went from being a really prestigious, important title,
governing, like a wrestling governing body of the promoters and stuff like that,
and then it floated on to a different kind of path.
It reflects 80s business, it reflected 70s business and 80s business and 90s business into two major companies in America, WWF and WCW. Then Vince McMahon conquering the world era, then technology to go with it, and just it really, really symbolized the nature of wrestling business.
I think there's a lot of
always
to take away.
Need world heavyweight title. I mean, it's a pyramid, you know. I mean, not the pyramid business, but you always have this cluster of wrestlers. It doesn't matter how many, you know, 200 wrestlers in the roster. I mean, WWE is so big that so many wrestlers in the roster, but you still have same number of guys on top. That's about it, you know. Yeah, I mean, 200 wrestlers on the contract. You only have 30 wrestlers on TV.
Right, right.
Yeah. So, but we learn a lot from this world title history. Yeah.
If anybody has questions or comments about NWA Championship in Japan, NWA Champions.
We'll do an AWA portion sometime soon. Okay.
Yes. Because that has its own separate history.
Separate history and the different, you know, they went out of business. And I learned that the company as big as AWA was, that can go out of business. You know, it was shocking in '90s, you know, like in 1990 to be exact. Anyhow, if anybody has a question on Twitter, at Fumihiko Dayo, FumihikoDayo, Fumihiko Dayo, or just Fumi Saito on Facebook. Please message me first.
And on Twitter, I'm at Justin M. Nipper, KNIPPER. All right, that's it for this week. Fumi, take it away.
So long from Tokyo.
Write that down, Fumi Saito. Write that down, Fumi Saito. Write that down for me, Slater. Write that down for me, Slater. Write that down.